Well, as I have mentioned, we are starting a new series this morning entitled Unveiled, and for the next 2 months, we are going to be diving into the book of Revelation. If you've been around, if you remember back in the beginning of 2022, I still have a hard time believing I've been here that long, longer than that. 2022, we spent a couple months going through the seven letters in chapters 2 and 3. I figured if you were going to start in Revelation, that's a safe place to go. But I did say at that time, we will eventually come back around and do the rest of the book. Well, eventually is apparently June 2026, so that's where we're going to be. And I had originally planned on the series being 7 weeks, and then it went to 8 weeks. And now in the last week, I've added another one. So we're going to be in here 9 weeks. I was not planning on doing anything with chapters 2 and 3 since we had been through those. But it feels like if I skip that, we're going to miss a very important element of the context in which this book was written, addressing these churches. And so next week, we're going to do a 30,000 foot flyover and zip through, visit 7 churches in about a half hour, if you can imagine that. And just to see what Jesus really through John has to say to them and how it relates to everything else we're going to read in the book. But I would imagine if I were to take a poll in here this morning of which book of the Bible has caused you the most confusion and maybe even anxiety, it's probably, if Revelation isn't at the top of the list, it's near the top of the list. Let me just get this right out of the gate. It's a weird book. It's hard to know sometimes what to do with it. And when most of us hear that word Revelation, especially when words are hard, especially when it's referring specifically to this book. And let me say, this is just a pet peeve of mine, it's Revelation, not Revelations. There's one revelation in this book. I won't mention that anymore. We don't think of, oh, wonderful. We're going to talk about comfort and hope and encouragement. No, we think of end times charts and conspiracy theories and 70s and 80s Christian movies that scarred an entire generation. If you've seen those movies, you know which ones I'm talking about. Movies where people just suddenly disappear and cars crash and some poor teenager misses out because he didn't go to youth group on Wednesday night. I mean, things like that. And of course, we all know those people. The people who, they're either on Facebook or maybe it's somebody in your family, who every major world event is either tied to the Antichrist or it's a sign of the mark of the beast. Which has been everything from, I've got a list here, let me read it. Credit cards, social security numbers, barcodes, microchips, even the self-checkout at Walmart. So maybe in your experience, you have just avoided the book altogether. You may have tried to start reading it and you got to 4 horsemen and locusts with human faces and you thought, I think I'll spend some time with David in the Psalms. It feels like he has some issues, but at least I can relate to that. And I get it. I really do, because those are the very things that have caused me to think, you know what? I just don't know that I want to spend a lot of time in this book right now. It's strange. The book of Revelation has possibly been the most mishandled, misrepresented, misinterpreted book in all of Scripture. And I'm not making a promise that I'm going to answer all or even a fraction of the questions we have about it. But my question is this: what if the problem is not with the book? What if it's with the way we've been reading it? Or the way that we have been told we need to read it? What if we need a different perspective? What if we need new lenses? And what if those lenses are 2,000 years old? What if those lenses are first century lenses? Because to the first century readers and even into the early second century, Revelation really wasn't scary at all. Those, they didn't need a book to scare them. They were already scared. They were already uncertain. Everywhere they looked, Rome was in charge and in control. They were already living in fear and uncertainty. They didn't need a puzzle to solve. They needed hope. And that is exactly what this letter gave them. So my primary goal over these next couple months is not to, like I said, it's not to answer all of the questions. And I hope you grabbed one of the journals. You'll notice on the back of the bulletins, there's just some questions for you to think about throughout the week. And we'll have a little bit of a challenge of how you can apply some of the things, because it's not the most immediately accessible book in terms of application, but there are things that we can do in our lives to live out the message. But I want to change our perspective on the book. I want us to move from seeing it as the scary one that we avoid to seeing it as the book that we turn to when we desperately need hope and some good news. And if you're wondering how you find hope in the book of Revelation, well, the name of the book itself in the original Greek was a hopeful word. It's the word apocalypsis, which is where we get the word apocalypse. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Apocalypse does not, I don't think, hope. I think nuclear fallout and wastelands and all of those things. But in the first century, that word apocalypse did not mean anything like that. It was an architectural and theatrical word. It literally means unveiling. Revelation. It's a revelation. It's a revealing. It's the picture of pulling back a heavy curtain so that what is hidden can now be clearly seen. Think of a big theatrical play. Steph and I went to go see Les Mis around Christmas, and you know, as the show starts, they bring the lights down, and you're wondering, what is this going to look like behind the curtain and everything? And the music swells, the curtain opens, and you see it. And that's an apocalypsis. They don't do this so much in weddings anymore, but when the groom pulls the veil back on the bride, that's an apocalypsis. So that might change your perspective on when the groom gets his first look at the bride. That is an apocalypse. You can see where that kind of changes. Yeah, I'm glad I got a chuckle out of that. Somebody got it.
My wife's not in here,
right? Yeah, you can chuckle. She's not in. So I say all that to tell you that this book is not primarily a book about destruction. It's not a book about fear or uncertainty. It is an unveiling. And what is being unveiled in the book is not necessarily the Antichrist. It's not necessarily a timeline for world war. It's not even a what. What's being unveiled is a who. In fact, the very first verse of the book tells us who is being revealed. Revelation 1:1. This is a revelation from or of Jesus Christ. It's amazing to me how quick we will skip past the opening words of some of Scripture sometimes. That tells us everything we need to know about this book. This is a revelation of Jesus Christ. Some of your translations will say some, or will say of, or let me start that over again. They will say from, but if you look at the footnotes, it says of. So both of those words are correct. This revelation is from Jesus Christ, and guess who it's of? Himself. That's the purpose of this book. The entire purpose of Revelation is to show us Jesus, who he is, what he's done, what he's doing right now, and what he will do in the future. So that question I like to joke about is Revelation about what has happened, what is happening, or what will happen? Yes, it's about all of those things. And the tricky part is that it's not necessarily linear. So it doesn't start with things that have happened and will end with things that are going to happen, although there is that in there. It's a vision. It's a revelation. And so we have to keep that in mind. So I want to establish a ground rule for this right off the bat. If you read Revelation, if we get to the end of these 9 weeks, and you are more fascinated with a beast than the Lamb, I have failed. We have missed the entire point of the book. If you leave more consumed by the when than the who, we've missed it. This book is all about Jesus. And that should encourage us. That is very good news. And I think something else that we either forget or sometimes we don't realize about this book is that it's a letter. It's a very real letter written by a real pastor by the name of John to seven very real struggling churches in the first century in Asia Minor, which would be modern-day Turkey. It's not fantasy. It's not science fiction, although it reads like that sometimes. John didn't eat bad seafood and start seeing things. No. This is a deeply pastoral letter written to Christians who were under immense pressure and persecution. And if you would like to know a couple of the resources that I'm using for this, there is a book called Reading Revelation Responsibly. That's a mouthful to say. By Michael Gorman. That is a wonderful book. There's another one called Resisting Empire, and the name of the author is escaping me right now, but somebody wrote it. Also, a very incredible leader in the Church of the Nazarene, Dan Boone, has a short book on the book of Revelation that I would heartily recommend to you. If you see that name on a book, read it. He's incredible. President of Tribeca Nazarene University, just can't say enough about him. But Michael Gorman, in his book, Reading Revelation Responsibly, says that what John writes here is an alternate script for living. And what I mean by that is this. Rome had a script, and its script consisted of just a couple lines. Caesar is Lord, and Rome is eternal. The power and peace of Rome is the only thing that you need. It's the only thing that's keeping the world functioning and going. Its military might, its economic prosperity, its political dominance, those were divine blessings. And if you want to flourish, you submit, you swear allegiance, and you participate in the empire. And to the average person in one of these seven cities, in Ephesus or Pergamum or one of these others we're going to look at, that script sounded and felt like it was unshakable, absolute reality because it was all they could see when they looked around. But John says, not so fast. Let's talk a little bit about John. By this point, and this is John the Apostle, he's a very old man by this time. It is highly likely, and I don't even think it's just highly likely, I would say this pretty authoritatively, he is the last remaining of the 12 apostles. And he's been exiled to this prison island called Patmos precisely because he refused to buy into the script that Caesar is Lord. And John says, no, I don't think so. Actually, Jesus is Lord. And Rome did not appreciate that correction. And so they sent him to this desert, or it wasn't even a desert island, it was a volcanic island, still exists, to shut him up. Because they couldn't kill him. They tried multiple times to kill him, and apparently that wouldn't take. And so they sent him to this island thinking they could get rid of it. And so I want you to picture this scene, the historical context in which John is experiencing this. It's this letter written by this exiled pastor to these suffering churches from a prison colony. These were not ideal situations. It was not an ideal environment. The churches that he is writing to, they are facing the exact same type of persecution that has landed John on this island for what he's done. It was very real. It was very visceral pressure. These Christians are exhausted. They're afraid. They're confused. And they are wrestling with these questions. Does God still see us? Is Jesus actually reigning? Is following him worth it? Because from where we're sitting, it looks like Rome sure is powerful and they're in charge. In fact, they might have looked a little bit like this guy right here. Now, if you are a Cub fan, you recognize that picture from this last week. Even that's just a sign that even some of the best get lost. That's Pete Crow Armstrong lost a fly ball in the lights at Wrigley Field and gave up an in-the-park home run. Go Cubs! But sometimes it feels like that. God, where are you? I don't know that he was ball, where are you? Okay, you could take that down now. I only show that picture because Matt showed it to me today and said, I think this belongs in a sermon. And he was right. It did. But that's the historical context that we're dealing with here. These churches are struggling. They're suffering. But as he writes these churches, John is not just worried about the violent persecution that they're facing. In fact, there are many scholars that believe that that wasn't the biggest issue facing the church. And if you, as we will get into those seven letters next week, those kind of bear it out that that's not the biggest thing they're facing. What the danger that they were facing was something that was far more subtle and far more dangerous: assimilation. Most Christians, unless they were very vocal like John and just wouldn't shut up, they weren't being hunted down and sent off to prison islands. Now, that's not to say that some of them weren't facing things like that. I mean, Nero had his heyday with doing terrible things to Christians. But for most of them, the temptation or the issue was that they were being tempted to compromise just enough to keep their jobs, to keep their social standing, to enjoy the luxuries of the empire. Many of them were thinking, you know, it can't be, is it really that bad to just burn a little incense to the emperor? I mean, we're still worshiping Jesus in our hearts. Can we just fit in without making waves? And the issue was that they were slowly but surely absorbing the values of the empire that were built on economic exploitation, military dominance, and systemic idolatry. Now, I keep using this word, empire, and I'm going to use it often in this series. And so I want to give us a little bit of a working definition. This isn't in my sermon. This was something that was added. Because I think it's important, because when we hear the word empire, if you're a nerd, the first thing you think of is Darth Vader and him striking back. No, that's not what we're talking about here. Or you think you have other images. I don't know that, obviously Rome is the empire specifically that John is referring to here, but he also mentions Babylon. He also mentions Assyria. And so this is a multifaceted kind of thing that John is talking about here. And so here's a little bit of a working definition. In the book of Revelation, empire isn't just a political government or a map with borders. It is a massive, everyday system that promises you safety, wealth, and comfort, but it demands your ultimate loyalty, your morals, and your worship in return. Empire is simply human society organizing itself to function without God and then punishing anyone who doesn't bow to the system. Don't worry about writing that down. I can, if you want it, I'll give it to you. We'll get it on Facebook. And that was a lot to try to write down in one shot. But that's the image I want us to keep in mind. It's not necessarily a political structure. It's anything, any system that functions in a way that tries to remove God from the equation and then punishes anybody who won't get with the program. Obviously, as I said, Rome is the big one here. And that's what John is addressing. So what this early church needed was they needed an apocalypse. They needed an unveiling. And they either needed it because they needed to be shaken awake from their sleep and their slumber, or they needed to be encouraged. They needed a revelation of who it was who was actually running things. And that's what John experiences on Patmos. He gets to see the curtain pulled back. And the very first thing that he sees are not scrolls with seals. They're not trumpets or bowls or beasts or anything like that. He sees something that reminds him, because he's not having the best of times either. He sees something that reminds him that Rome is not the final authority. They are not the ultimate reality, and neither is any other earthly empire. He gets to see everything from heaven's perspective, and his vision unveils who actually runs the universe. And if you're wondering who that was, verse 1 already told us who that was. It's Jesus Christ. And then verse 5 tells us this. He is the faithful witness to these things, the first to arise from the dead, and the ruler of all the kings of the world. All glory to him who loves us and has freed us from our sins by shedding his blood for us. He has made us a kingdom of priests for God his Father. All glory and power to him forever and ever. And you can go ahead and say it with me. Amen. So before there's any weird things that he sees, well, that's not quite true because this is kind of a weird vision, but before there's any complex images or crazy multi-headed beasts, John gets to see and is reminded of the foundational truth of the gospel. Jesus is Lord. He is the one who loves us. He is the one who has freed us. And how has he done that? Well, he hasn't done it the same way that Rome does. He hasn't shed the blood of his enemies. He shed his own blood on our behalf. That is the great paradox that runs not just through the book of Revelation, but through the entire story of redemption. Our freedom, our redemption, our forgiveness was not bought because Jesus crushed everyone else. He allowed himself to be crushed. Empires conquer by inflicting death. Jesus took that upon himself willingly and lovingly. He allowed his body, his own life to be broken for us. And out of that sacrificial love, he has not only purchased redemption and freedom for us, he has made us a whole other kingdom, a kingdom of priests. Now, what does a priest do? A priest is someone who kind of stands in the gap on behalf of God, in between God and the people around them. Priests are called to embody and reflect the character of the one that they are representing. That is who we are called to be. We are not called to be an empire of soldiers who uses the world's weapons. We are called to embody the self-giving, cruciform love of Jesus in the midst of a violent world. We don't become monsters to fight the monsters. We are called to reflect the Lamb. And with that foundation set, John continues. Starting at verse 10, it says this. It was the Lord's day, and I was worshiping in the Spirit. Now, I want to pause there real quick, because I think that is a very important element of the story. I think John was the one who was blessed to see this vision because of how he had postured his heart. Remember, he's on this island because he will not shut up about Jesus. He won't stop. They couldn't do anything to stop him. And so here he is. And while he's there, I don't know what he was doing in his prayer, but he was worshiping. He wasn't in a nice cathedral setting. He was on an island wondering when he was going to die. And he's worshiping God. And so he gets to experience this revelation, this vision. And it says, suddenly I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet blast. It said, write in a book everything you see and send it to the seven churches. When I turned to see who was speaking to me, I saw seven golden lampstands. And standing among the lampstands was someone like the Son of Man. He was wearing a long robe with a gold sash across his chest. His head and his hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like flames of fire. His feet were like polished bronze and refined in a furnace, and his voice thundered like mighty ocean waves. He held seven stars in his right hand, and a sharp two-edged sword came from his mouth, and his face was like the sun in all its brilliance. Now, this is sometimes the place where people say, okay, that's weird. Things are getting a little strange. Because John turns after he hears this voice, and he sees this breathtaking vision, and what he sees is nothing less than the resurrected, glorified and exalted Christ. The same Jesus he saw ascend to heaven, this is what he looks like now. And I want to, if you didn't know this already, this is where Revelation gets a little bit tricky, because Revelation communicates a lot and mostly through images. And it does it the same way that poetry does through metaphor. If you have to have a certain kind of mind, a certain kind of heart, and a certain kind of spirit to be able to decipher the images. Remember, this was written to believers. They were people, many of whom knew what they were looking at when they read this letter. And the images that are here, they aren't meant to confuse, although they do confuse certain people who don't know what to do with them. They're meant to reveal truths that worldly eyes and worldly hearts can't quite decipher. And they're also doing it in a way that normal prose and normal words just can't do. Think of it like a political cartoon, almost. When you see a picture of Uncle Sam, you don't think, oh, America is literally an old man with a long beard and a top hat. No, you know that is a metaphor. Uncle Sam is an image representing America. And it's the same idea here. The same thing is going on here, but on a much deeper level. And John's original audience would have immediately recognized many of these images because they were pulled right from the scriptures that they were reared in, the Old Testament. It is a master class in biblical imagery. The robe and the golden sash, that's priestly attire. That is revealing Jesus as the great high priest. The white hair, that is Daniel's Ancient of Days, a symbol of eternal divinity. Eyes like blazing fire, those are the eyes that David knew were searching his heart, that he couldn't escape from. Eyes that saw everything, the truth, the pain, the injustice, the compromise. The bronze feet symbolized unyielding strength and stability over evil. They were the feet that survived the fire in Daniel's vision. The voice like rushing waters, the same voice that spoke creation into existence. The sword from his mouth represents the word, obviously. It's carrying ultimate authority, truth, judgment, and life. His face like the sun in all its brilliance. He is the light of the world. The symbols are the language. And when you begin to understand, and when you begin to learning the language, then Revelation becomes a little less frightening, because you can see what these images are pointing to. And it starts to become actually a little bit more beautiful. And the point of all this intense imagery is, look at how weird Jesus is. No, it's look at how glorious Jesus is. Here he is. He is unveiled in all of his cosmic majesty. So how do you respond to something like that? Well, I can tell you how John responded. In verse 17, it says, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as if I were dead." Well, of course he did. The sheer majesty of what he's witnessing knocked him flat. I think it's very similar to what Paul experienced on the road to Emmaus. Or, no, where was he? He's on his road to Damascus. Yeah, Damascus. See, I get my Bible stories confused. Those are other people on the road to Emmaus. But he got to see and experience Jesus unveiled. And he didn't even know how to talk about it. He just knew that it knocked him off his feet and he couldn't see for a few days. It's the exact same thing. And what that reminds us is that Jesus he's not someone that we approach casually. We can approach him confidently and comfortably, but not casually. He isn't just inspiring, he is holy, he is glorious, and he is king. And sometimes the only response is to fall on our face as if we were dead. But then comes my favorite part of chapter 1, because the very next thing we see is Jesus reaching down to this old pastor, and he says, John writes, "But he laid his right hand on me and said, 'Don't be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I died, but look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and the grave. Now remember, John spent 3 years with him, watched him arrested, watched him crucified, maybe even witnessed his burial, got to walk with him for 40 days after his resurrection, has witnessed faithfully to him for decades. He's the last one of those original 12, and he still needs to be reminded, you don't have to be afraid of me. And you can imagine what he's experiencing in the moment. Well, maybe we can't imagine what he's experiencing in this moment. But he's on a prison island. He's feeling the weight of his own exile. He's feeling the anxiety of all of these churches that he loves. And now he has the shock of this vision on top of everything else. And Jesus doesn't leave him there in terror. Yes, you worm. No. He reaches down. He puts his hand on his shoulder and he says, don't be afraid. And you realize those are the first spoken words of the book of Revelation. A book that we are so afraid of. And the first words out of Jesus' mouth are, don't be afraid. Do you hear what Jesus is saying to John? And he's saying to these churches, and by extension, he is saying to us, he's saying, Rome isn't the first. They're not the last. I am. I was dead, and I've already been to the place that you are scared to go to. I went to the darkest place imaginable, and I walked out with the keys. Death couldn't hold me. I own the place. It doesn't get the last word. Oh, and on top of that, I'm with you. Don't be afraid. Do you see why the book of Revelation is full of hope? If Jesus is the first and the last, if he is alive forever, if he is holding the keys to the worst the world can throw at us, we don't have anything to fear, including anything we read in this book. Fear has no right to dominate our lives. We don't have to live in anxiety about the future, and we don't have to compromise to keep peace in the present and to find security. Our King has already won, and he's standing over us saying, don't be afraid. I think sometimes we want, our struggle sometimes is we want everything laid out. We want predictions and timelines and all of these things, and Revelation keeps grabbing us by the shoulders and saying, no, look here. This is all you need to see. It keeps pointing our eyes to Jesus. Look at him. Look at the Lamb. Look at the King who walks among the lampstands, who holds his people in his hands. And if you're wondering what those lampstands mean, this is how John closes chapter 1. Jesus gives a clarification about some of the imagery that John is witnessing here. In verse 20, he says this, this is the meaning of the mystery of the seven stars you saw in my right hand and the seven gold lampstands. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. Now, that sort of clears things up, and not so much, because who are the angels? Well, we don't know. But there was apparently at least a spirit that God put over each of these churches as kind of their messengers. And I don't know what you think about guardian angels, but that might have been something like that. These were spirits that had charge of these churches that God had put in that place. So the lampstands are the churches. And where was Jesus standing? In verse 13, it said he was standing among the lampstands. That is a beautiful image. He wasn't standing outside, hovering over the lampstands. He wasn't ruling them from a distance. He was moving among them. He was walking right in the thick of everything that they were experiencing. And he's still standing among his churches, among his people, right here with us, in our questions, in our anxieties, in our daily struggles. And that's the image that I want to close with this morning. If you take nothing else from chapter 1, it's this. Don't be afraid. I think Jesus may have said that a little more gently to John. But if I can command you to don't be afraid. The one who is the first and the last, who is the Alpha and Omega, who was dead, but now is alive forevermore, who holds the keys of death and hell, he's standing not just over you, but among you and with you, holding you, walking with you. And he's about to show you, I'm in charge of all of this. You don't have to fear any of this. So as we step out of these doors in just a few moments and we head back into the rhythms of our world, the environment of the empire, remember the script that the world is going to hand you. It's a script of anxiety. It's a script of panic and pressure. It's a script that tells you that you have to compromise to stay secure, or you can live in constant fear that it's going to take you out. But this morning, the curtain has been pulled open. You don't have to live by the world's script. You belong to the King who holds the keys. When you feel overwhelmed by the pressure to assimilate or exhausted by the brokenness of the world, I want you to picture that right nail-scarred hand gently resting on your shoulder. And I want you to hear him whisper to you, "Don't be afraid." And can we be honest? Because I know some of the fear we feel it's not about us. We know people who are on the wrong side of this curtain. And while we can have hope that we don't have anything to fear, man, it scares us to death. What's waiting? Can I encourage you? The best way to give them hope is to give them hope. To say, you know, Jesus, you don't have to be afraid. He's told me that. I've experienced that. You don't have to live this way anymore. Here's Jesus. You don't have anything to be afraid of. He owns death. That's how we conquer fear. You don't conquer fear with bigger fear. You conquer it with hope. And if ever there was hope to be found, it's found in Jesus. So let's go out this week as a kingdom of priests and take the self-giving, unshakable hope of the Lamb into every room we walk into. The victory is already His. Amen? Would you pray with me?